Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we will talk with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She is the author of 7 books of fiction and nonfiction, and perhaps people will know her for her book, The Hidden Life of Dogs, a book that has been very, very popular, has sold widely. Her others include books The Harmless People, Reindeer Moon, and The Animal Wife. She's also written for The New Yorker, National Geographic, The Atlantic Monthly. We will talk this morning about an aspect of her life, something that has been an interest virtually throughout her entire life, that started when she was a teenager, when her family, her mother, father, she and a brother moved to Africa and spent some time in the Kalahari living with the Bushmen. As a result, she wrote a book, that's The Harmless People, that has long been considered a very popular work of anthropology and something that continues to be in print. That was first published, I believe, in 1959. This was in 1950 when she and her family went to Africa. Her mother became a noted ethnographer, writing books about these people. Her brother became a documentary filmmaker, making movies about them. And she has published a book now, actually came out last fall, that is in part memoir, in part exploration of the lives of the Bushmen. The book is titled The Old Way, A Story of the First People. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm certain that you can still find it in the bookstore or in the library. And we'll talk a little bit this morning with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas about some of her experiences, going back to the time when she was a teenager, and about the Bushmen, how they lived then and how they live now. And questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people can call. We just ask callers to be brief so that we can accommodate as many as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Ms. Thomas, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Back at that time in 1950, when your dad decided to move the family to Africa, this would have been a time when certainly not very much was known about these people. Some people, in fact, thought that they were potentially dangerous. It's difficult to imagine someone making this decision. Certainly, your family members, they weren't anthropologists by training. They couldn't speak the language. What possessed your dad and made him want to take the family and make this trip and go to Africa?
Well, he liked to do things like that. He was the kind of person that didn't want to see the smoke of his neighbor's chimney. he loved the idea of a very large wilderness that was essentially unexplored. And to use the word unexplored is ironic, because people had been living there since the Paleolithic or way before, but it was unmapped, let's put it that way. We were the first non-Bushman people to go to the areas that we went to. And as far as is known, and he thought that these people would be very interesting to know. It seemed to us even back then that this would be the way of life that people had lived since people began. I mean, hunters and gatherers. We were all hunters and gatherers for the first 150,000 years of our time on Earth. And here were people who were living without any, no domestic animals, no domestic plants, no fabric, no mechanical items, nothing manufactured, just living from the savannah. And it was very interesting and wonderful to be there.
When you were at the time were 19 years old, you were in college?
Yes, I was, and I took a junior year abroad.
So were you completely enthusiastic about this? Or
I was very, yes, yeah, we all yeah. were, yes, very much so, very yeah. much so. It was a wonderful experience.
Tell us a little bit about the landscape. What is the Kalahari like?
Well, back then, it was, it's changed a bit since, but I'm talking about about 120,000 square miles. A lot of it was bushveld. That would be low bushes, small trees, fairly small trees, far apart, fairly far apart, or groves of small trees. And by small, I mean maybe a few inches in diameter at the trunk, but not big, not a big established forest. The trees that were big were baobab trees, and they were enormous. There weren't very many of them. They could be 2,000 years old, and so big that a whole group of people couldn't reach around them. It's just huge trees. Otherwise, it was hot and dry. Almost all the trees and bushes had thorns, which are a water conservation mechanism for plants. The food that people found would be from the savanna. It would be roots, also several kinds of berries. And then when the rains came, the whole desert would turn green and beautiful, and there would be fruit and vegetable foods. And it was fairly flat, rolling country. You could see if you got up in a high place at all or climbed a baobab tree, you could see indefinitely far. It was perfectly beautiful, beautiful place.
This would be a place where at least at certain times of the year, maybe one would say at all times of the year, it would be a tough place to make a living, to survive.
Yes, it was. Well, the people who were there, the Xhukla Bushmen were the people that we visited. They managed very well indeed. I mean, they were extremely capable people, very strong, and they knew so much. Their knowledge was just phenomenal about everything of the environment. They were botanists and zoologists, and I mean, they knew everything. And so it was difficult, but difficult is a funny word. It was hard work, but people knew what they were doing, and they really, they'd been there for, again, since the Paleolithic, mm-hmm. and they still were there, and that's a success story. That is quite a success story.
Well, certainly they would have to be experts on their, for to have survived in that environment, they would have to be experts on their environment.
Yes.
They know everything there was to know.
Exactly, everything there was to know, yes.
And I think at one point you note in the book that at one point the thinking was that these people might have come to the Kalahari from someplace else, but that then we get this appreciation, or at some point we decide that, in fact, no, it wasn't that they lived on the periphery and somehow were driven into living there, that these people had virtually always been living there.
Well, yes, the archaeological findings at the settlements, people made their encampments on the shores of seasonal lakes, because this is where water would be found. Another thing that I did not mention about the Kalahari is that there's very little water. The only water is there is in some permanent water holes. There were eight or nine in the area that we studied, and only some of them were permanent. And so these encampments would have been there, were there still in use, and archaeological findings showed that they had been there for 30,000 years, perhaps, uninterrupted occupancy, and very little change in the material culture, if any. And so that shows a huge cultural stability and success.
When you and your family went there, you really didn't know how it is that you were going to make contact with these
people.
No,
we didn't. We didn't know where they were or where people were or how to find them. We had guides. We had of course, at one time, bushmen and hunter-gatherers lived all over Africa, all over southern Africa. And when the European farmers came and they would establish farms, they would usually take the bushmen who were in that area. They would try to make them into farm laborers. So from populations like that, we found people who knew the interior somewhat, and or who had connections with the interior. And we went with those people, with some of those people, to a waterhole called Kam, and which they knew about. And there we found people who knew about further into the interior. And the other people showed us into the interior. Oh, people didn't really want to. It isn't that the people didn't know about white people. They did, and what they knew was not good. So we thought we would have, perhaps there were people that we might have found who did not want to meet us and would have escaped. The white people had an extremely bad reputation, extremely bad. But we did find people who, our interpreters vouched for us, and we found a wonderful community of people who we became friends with, and the friendships we made then have lasted into three generations and will be there as long as any of us are alive. Yeah.
So you were not the first white people that the Bushmen had encountered?
Well, no, we would have been the first that people had encountered. It was news of the white people that had spread.
Oh, they knew white people not by reputation. What they knew by reputation was not
good. That's right.
Uh-huh. So that makes it surprising that the people that you met and whom you got to know and who you lived alongside would be as gracious and as welcoming as apparently they were. That seems some people might find that surprising.
Well, they were gracious, welcoming people. They were not a warlike people. The area that we were in, excuse me, the area that we were in, the people would be in contact with one way or another with everybody else in the area. It was one group spread very widely, you could say. There were about 550 people in our study area, if you could put it that way, and that would have taken up about 6,000 square miles. But the people were in touch with each other because they would visit each other from time to time, or they would meet at different places from time to time. We had an interesting look at this. My mother gave people as a gift cowrie shells, and there were no cowrie shells in the whole Nya Nya area. There wasn't one. And my mother gave several women a bunch of cowrie shells. And a year later, the people that we met and had given the shells to, not one shell remained, but there were shells all over Nya Nya. In other words, people had traveled, given each other gifts, and then those people had given other people gifts. So for every cowrie shell that moved across the Nya Nya area, any news would also be moving. So in other words, people had every way of hearing. It would take a year to do it, but with 150,000 years behind you, as this is a way of life, a year is not all that long, so a lot of information could travel very freely.
Mm-hmm. How do you have some sense of how it is these people regarded you, in particular how they thought about the relationship between you and them, and whether you and they were essentially the same, or whether they continued to think that in some important ways that you and they were really different?
Well, the difference would be in possessions. I mean, we had vehicles, we had a rifle, we had all kinds of possessions, and they had the things of the felt. But they knew that before we came. They knew that non-Bushmen had more stuff. They had a story about that to explain how that had taken place why they got the wrong end of there was a tug of war and they got the wrong end of the rope and got just the things of the felt while the other people got the cattle and the guns and whatever we have, all the stuff that we have. So that was part of it. But as for their being nice to us, they were very, very cordial, very welcoming. They agreed to talk with us and to help us understand the way of life they had. They took us into their family. They gave us names and relationships so that we fit into the social system, which was a very welcoming thing to do. The Zuclasi do that quite readily. I mean, if you went there now, I would think that the same thing would happen. They'd give people names and fit them in to include them, and it's a very nice. They're very nice people.
Yeah. I think I would expect that would go against the idea that some people would have, maybe based on what the world is like today, that the idea of tribalism in the sense that we consider ourselves and our group to be, we're the people and everybody else, well, they're something else. They're certainly not members of our family. Maybe we regard them as members of our species, but that there's this very much this mentality that says there's us and there's them.
I think that's human. I think all human groups have that worked into their fabric somehow. They had that too. The non-Bushmen were called, they called non-Bushmen animals without hooves, which would be predators. And they called themselves, Zhu means person, and Wa means clear or pure, or I translated it as harmless. You might say, Mi Wa, and that would, and show your empty hands, and that would mean I'm clean. I don't have a gun. I don't have a spear. I don't have a bow and arrow. Don't have a weapon. And that's what that's how they saw themselves, and rightly so. But they it isn't that they never fought with anybody. They did and would if especially when the people came to take their land, they would try to fight for their lives. But among themselves, they felt that peace or nonviolence was the way to go, and that was very successful for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I don't mean to harp on this point, but I'm sure that some people would be surprised that for people who, if they said we're the harmless people and everybody else are predators, then that would put you in the and your family in the category being the predators. So they must have at least had a little bit of concern about what kind of people you were.
Oh, they did. They did have concern, and they would have been very concerned. And we did meet one group who they thought we had left. We camped in a place where we thought that there were people. Excuse me. But when one of our trucks drove away, and the people heard it go and thought we'd gone, and two of the men came back to their camp to get their stuff, and they figured we'd captured them. They said, "Okay, you got us," and we then explained that we were there to try to learn from them, and we convinced them that we were not going to be doing anything bad, and they at that point called in the other people, and we got to know that group very well. That was in another place, but that was the kind of, I mean, they did not want to encounter whites at all, and with excellent reason. I mean, both white and Bantu people had been not that great to them. The Bantu people perhaps not as bad.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She is the author of a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction. Maybe some people will know her for her book, The Hidden Life of Dogs, and perhaps also for an earlier book that she wrote, The Harmless People, which was based on her experiences living with her family, mother, father, brother, in the Kalahari among the Bushmen. This was starting out back in 1950, where, when she, as she mentioned, her father, who was interested in going places and seeing things that other people had never seen, made the decision to go there and to see if we could travel there and get to know the people and get to know that place. Her mother wrote a lot about these people. Her brother made documentary films about them. She wrote this book, The Harmless People, and wrote a book that was just published last fall that's in part a memoir about her experiences there when she was 19 years old with her family, about what the life of the Bushmen was then and what their life is like now. This book is titled The Old Way, A Story of the First People, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. And the idea clearly behind the title is, as you explained, that as far as we can tell, the way that these people were living when, at least in 1950, when there was likely the way that they had lived for maybe 100,000 years or more, and that what we're seeing was something close to what life would have been for some of the earliest humans. Yes?
Yes.
We have a caller here and would welcome others. If people have questions, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Lovington, and that would be on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi. Yes.
I had a question. What was the health of these people like? I've seen some stuff on the Amazon. People, it looks like things are horrible. I just wonder, you know, how their lifespan and, you know, how their general health was. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
On cell phone. Thank you.
All right.
Their health was, all the people we knew, their health was good. They did not have, at that time, there was no malaria there, for instance. There were malaria mosquitoes, but no malaria parasites. And this was true of a lot of diseases that just hadn't gotten in there. And their health was very good. And people lived to, I mean, we knew people in their 70s and 80s. So the lifespan was very much the same as ours, I'd say. They didn't have the terrible diseases that people have now are due to overcrowding, poverty, malnutrition. This, when you see an African population or any population with these terrible problems, it's because of the conditions in which they have to live. But don't forget that our species lived as we're a savanna animal, and we lived that way we lived by hunting and gathering. And we came to where we are today because we once were good hunter-gatherers, and so it's a very good way of life for us. We evolved to be that way. What we are, if you will, is the answer to what is a good way for people to for people to live in a savanna environment, and the answer is us. So the conditions were excellent for people. I would say the conditions were very good. People had problems in years of drought. There would be problems, and there would be hunger. It was a lot of work to get enough food, but people did the work and got what they needed, and were really very healthy. And in the bad diseases of babies, infant diarrhea and things like that, they didn't have that back then. Now they live in different conditions. Everybody in Namibia lives in different conditions. Namibia is very good for, it has clinics and it's interested in the welfare of its population, which is a very good thing. But the benefit of living in a small group with clean water and all that has been removed from a lot of people. Many people can't have that now. It's just not there. And the old way of life, the way that people used to live, is completely gone. There is nobody who lives that way anymore.
Can you talk a little bit about what at the time in 1950, when people were still living the way that they had, what, give you some sense of what daily life among the Bushmen would be like?
Well, it was pretty nice. The main food was plant foods, and mostly women gathered that. Men did the hunting. People would be in their encampment at night because of predators, and they would stay after dark, as it began to get dark, people would gather into their encampments, and they'd have fires, and they were very safe from the predators, and they had to keep watch for them, but nevertheless. And then through the night, most people would be asleep, but somebody would be awake. Always somebody was up, awake, and keeping watch, actually. And then after the sun had risen about maybe 45 degrees, not very high, but broad daylight, then people would start to, then the predators would have gone back to their resting places and would spend the day asleep. Lions, for instance, there were lions living right next to where, very near where we were, very near the waterhole that we camped at, and the lions used the water at night, and the people, and the landscape at night, and the people in the daytime. And then by mid-morning, if women were going to go gathering, they'd start out, they'd take little kids with them, and they would walk about maybe 5 miles or something, and they would to a place where they knew they would find a certain food that they were after, and they usually roots, and they would dig for the roots. If there were berries along the way, they'd pick them. Melons grew on vines. Throughout the year, you could find these melons on vines most of the year. And they would gather these, and they would come home. They would start home mid-afternoon and be home before the sky began to get, while the sun was setting, and then, or just before the sun began to set. And that would be the day, and it would be, they would take water with them. They would carry a drink of water in an ostrich eggshell, an empty ostrich eggshell, with a little grass plug to keep the water in it. And they would, they might eat some of the food they gathered as they were doing it, but they'd bring the rest home, and then the family would eat around the people would share the food. They shared everything. Everything was shared, and they would, people would be, have something to eat at night. And the men, when they went hunting, they might be gone for several days. They would hunt until they got something. And they used poison arrows, and the poison arrow took a while. The poison took a while to work. It might take a couple of days, maybe three, maybe 4 days to do its work. So they would hunt and stalk game until they got an arrow shot into something, and then they would note its tracks, and they would follow the tracks. They would follow the tracks until they found the animal dead or dying. And the point was to get there before something else got there, hyenas or lions or whatever else might take the food, take the meat. And then they would cut the meat up, and they might cook some and eat it. They would cook some and eat it there at the scene, and they would then carry the rest home. And then they'd share, everything was shared. They would share, every bit of meat would be shared. People would share again. People would share in large quantities, and then they'd share in smaller quantities. And so every single person would have something, would have a nice meal of meat. And it was the cooperation and the sharing that was a great focus for those people at that time. They put that as a very, very high priority.
Let us take another call from someone who's listening. This is someone in Champaign County on our line one. Hello.
Excuse me, I'm grazing right now. It'd be interesting just to hear you reel off these anecdotes, but I wonder if you would take a question about sort of the history of ideas in anthropology. There was a NOVA or a Nature on recently that covered the bonobos.
Yes.
And they actually had one of these, an anthropologist who said, what if we had discovered the bonobos before the chimpanzees, and we would have had an idea, chimpanzees being particularly belligerent, and early anthropologists sort of use that as a template for early culture, early human life. And if they had discovered the bonobos first, they would have had a completely different image of how people might actually be endowed in nature, quote unquote.
Yes.
So I don't know if that's. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Right. Well, I think that that's a very interesting thing to say, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if that were true. I think that we don't know how long the Bushmen are. DNA studies have shown that they are undoubtedly the first people that the rest of humanity evolved from them. And I also think that DNA studies have shown that we're probably human beings are probably a kind of chimpanzee rather than a kind of bonobo. But what the Bushmen had discovered at some point in their long history is that cooperation is a valuable tool. One of the things that made cooperation so important was the scarcity of water. People in the dry season had to live near water, and you had to live within a day's walk of a source of water. And if your water source dried, or if the food within a day's walk became unavailable, they had relatives, and they had gift partners, and a wide variety of other people who they could go to, and those people would welcome them, and they would be able to share the resources there. So the sharing and the welcoming was critical for life. And if whether this would pertain if the ecological conditions had been different, I don't know. Might not. But it was certainly a very good safety measure for people to be the way they were. And we're after all people. We can figure things out. So I think that my guess is that people simply figured out that this was a better way to. I don't know, but I would. I mean, nobody knows, but I would think that somewhere in the distant past, this turned out. The people who could do this, the people who were willing to share, the people who wanted others to welcome them so they would welcome the others when they came, that kind of thing. The people who worked out a complicated, very good social fabric, which the Bushmen most certainly did, those people probably made it and survived when people who couldn't do that fell by the wayside. So I think that they may have certainly, whether people are programmed, genetically programmed to be that way, I don't know. But the practical consequences are very clear, and so I think that they just did what made them survive, and they did survive.
Well, aside from perhaps this idea that people learned that in they're more likely to survive if they all cooperate and if they work together, if the group hangs together. Obviously, these people are very, you know, they and their way of life is very well adapted to this environment. If it wasn't, they wouldn't have been still living there after all this time.
Right.
So aside from the thing that we can learn of the adaptive advantage of group sort of coherence and cooperation. What are there some other things do you think that it's possible to learn about human beings and their behavior, why it is we behave in the way that we do by looking at the way that these people lived, at least at that time, the way that these people lived?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have a very a clear answer. The only thing I would say is that the sharing and the welcoming people to other resources and so forth and so on, that was not true of everybody. That was true of their own group. They had a very big, widespread group, and it was for the people within the group. If other people might come and want to take away their water source by force or something like that, they'd fight with those people. I mean, it isn't that they were just generally peace loving. It's that they worked things out within their own very large group to have the sharing and the lack of violence. So, I mean, we retained our chimpanzee ways to some extent, I believe. Which was necessary too, because otherwise you can't be completely. I mean, under those circumstances, you couldn't be completely pacific, so that you would just give anybody, whoever came along, you would give them your resources. You couldn't do that, and they didn't. And but what I have been talking about is the way the people who spoke the same language and called themselves by the same name, how they worked things out for themselves. And that was very successful, and we can certainly learn from that. I mean, I don't think we're going to, but I think we could.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was not all that long ago I had the opportunity to talk with Franz de Waal, who is the man who has written so much about the Bonobo and really helped to introduce them to a wider audience. And had a little conversation about this very question of, Who are we more like? Are we more chimpanzee-like or are we more bonobo-like? And I think his answer was, well, yes, actually, that we're both. You can see both of those aspects in our nature.
Yeah.
And you can't really, he was not going to say, no, you can't really say we are one or the other. You'd have to say, yes, there are some characteristics, some characteristic behaviors of both of those close relatives of ours that we have, and that we're capable of going either way.
I it's hard to disagree with that. I think that's perfectly true. Yes.
One of the things that, as we talked earlier, one of the things you would say about these people is that they are extraordinarily well adapted to their environment. And as you said, they know everything there is to know about, they're experts on their environment. And of course, to survive, they would have to be.
Yes.
What they have, though, in terms of technology is maybe, again, one would say is, well, they have everything that they need, but they don't have a lot of stuff. They don't have a lot of material possessions. They have what they need to get along, and that's what they have.
Yes.
It was there. Did you, I wonder, think about or maybe engage in conversations with people about why it is that they never, that they didn't feel the need to have tools, for example, other than the spear, the digging stick, other than the basic things that they had?
Well, they had the tools they needed. Don't forget that they would move from place to place for either to go visit relatives or gift partners or somebody at a great distance. Maybe people would travel up to 100 miles to visit. And you have to carry everything with you. And so that doesn't, I mean, a lot of possessions becomes something of a drag when you're carrying them in the hot sun all day. And I think that what I would say about the people that we knew is that they didn't need to accumulate a lot of stuff because what they needed was at hand. If you needed another a bow, you could find the right tree and make a bow. And if you needed another arrow, you could find the right materials and make one. And so it wasn't that you had to accumulate stuff against some rainy day. It was what you needed was more or less at hand. And we don't feel that way anymore. In this country, certainly in the Western world, we don't feel that what we need is at hand at all. We accumulate masses of stuff, most of which we really don't need. And it's just a whole different outlook, a whole different way of being, really.
Well, we certainly have a way of spending a lot of our time talking about quality of life and what it means, and often make the mistake, I'm sure some people would say, make the mistake of measuring that in terms of our material prosperity. It seems like the one way we have of trying to figure out, are we doing well, is by looking at our stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
if with people like this, do they even engage in conversations or thinking about this concept of quality of life? Or to them, are they too busy living to be thinking about or talking about quality of life? And is the life that we're leading the good life, the best life? Should we be doing something else?
Well, that is kind of two answers. For life in the old way that I wrote about, quality of life would be human relations. Good human relations would mean a good quality of life that other people wanted to share with you, that other people weren't jealous of you. You were very careful not to have people jealous of you. And this mitigates against having a lot of stuff, because nobody was supposed to have, nobody wanted to have more things or more anything than anybody else. People wanted levelness, was lack of jealousy, or to suppress anything that would lead to jealousy was very important. But that being said, now that people are living in towns, and most people are in one, nobody lives in the old way anymore. And now belongings have become more important. I mean, clothes, everybody had clothing back then, now people might want more kinds of clothing. They might want more tools. They might want more. I mean, it's just things change so much, and they have entered. Everybody now is in the. We're, everybody lives in the same world now, more or less. We didn't used to, but we do now, and with the same basic culture, I'd say. We. I don't know if you can really say that, but in many ways that would be true, and so they've just entered the kind of messed up world that we think of it, and that determines possessions and quality of life. Today, quality of life would, I think, for those people, the same values would apply. But And people would say that people would want what people want now, what the people I knew, what they would want now is to just be rural Namibians and live as their contemporaries live in Namibia, and that would involve a job and clothes and stuff like that, and it would also mitigate against hunger, because I mean now people have to buy food or they get a welfare ration and so forth and so on. These things would contribute, these kinds of things and the delivery of the welfare ration, that kind of thing, that would influence quality of life very much. And so people would talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Do that now that they are living, as you say, no one lives this way now. No one lives the old way anymore.
No.
As they are living a more conventional kind of, in a more conventional kind of way, in a settled way, they're not hunter-gatherers anymore. There are people who have jobs and wear clothes and
hopefully have jobs.
Well, hopefully, yeah. That would be the idea, as you say, that they would be living as an average person would. Are there people who mourn the old way and who say something like, you know, we were really better off when we were living like that than we are now?
I don't know. I would not be surprised that some people, especially the older people, don't forget, the people who are now in their 60s are the very last people who even saw the old way, because it began to disappear in 1960, and then in the 1960s, and by the 70s, by the 80s, it was pretty well gone, and by now it's completely gone. So there aren't very many people who remember how things were, and I don't know. I haven't been back for a long time. My brother was there until his death quite recently. Mm-hmm. And his point was that people wanted to be farmers. They wanted to have small herds of cattle and plant gardens and stuff like that, and having trouble doing that. But so they were looking sort of to the future and looking to. They're very realistic as a people, I would say, as a culture. I would say it was a very realistic culture. And I don't know of people mourning the past. I know that in Australia, there were people who had once lived in as hunter-gatherers. And the old people in those groups who remembered the past managed to convince some other people to return to the old way. And I don't know if it was successful or not, but they got tired of the violence and the alcohol and the so forth and so on and the crime and so forth that was plaguing people in, you know, slum areas and so forth. And the Bushmen have that same problem now. But so there may be people who still remember what things were like. It isn't that people were happy back then. They were happy. Some were happy and some weren't. I mean, there were always people saying things like, so-and-so isn't sharing with me, and I'm hungry, many, many complaints. So people didn't regard life as rosy. But and it's sort of hard to get to back away and get a general view of your life. That is kind of what other people do on your behalf. So I don't know if people regret the past. And it wasn't an easy life. I mean, it was very hard work. So, and there was uncertainties. I mean, if there was nobody to come and help you if things went wrong. I mean, if your group, your area, there was a drought and the wild foods didn't flourish, you were done for. So It had its disadvantages as well.
Our guest is Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's the author of a number of books, fiction and non. Maybe people will know her for her book, The Hidden Life of Dogs, or perhaps for her first book, which was published in 1959, The Harmless People, the result of her experiences living with her family, that her mom and dad and brother, in the Kalahari, getting to know and live with the Bushmen. Her mother wrote a lot about them as an anthropologist. Her brother made a number of documentary films, and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas published this book, that came out last fall, The Old Way, A Story of the First People, which is in large part a memoir of her experiences when she was there, 19 years old, in 1950, living with her family among the Bushmen. And the book's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm sure that you could find it in the bookstore or the library. And questions, welcome. Someone wants to get in here real quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I gather that there are some people who think it would be a good thing to take the Bushmen essentially and put them back. That is, introduce them back to the old way of living, the way that they used to live. Are there still people who are talking about that?
Oh yes, that's quite a popular viewpoint of, but mostly it's non-Bushmen who hold that view, and they've been. It's hard to blame people for feeling that way, because after all, here is a people who the Bushmen didn't ruin their environment like everybody else has done. They lived in a stable. They lived in such a way that they didn't ruin everything, and that's quite enviable. And I think that we look to that and think that this would be wonderful if at least some people could still be that way, but I don't know of any Chukchuma people who want to return or want to be hunter gatherers, and it's asking a lot. I mean, for people to young African men to go bow hunting and dress in skins and hunt with Stone Age implements when their contemporaries are hunting with rifles, it just doesn't. Things don't work that way. That isn't how it goes. And I really don't know of people who don't want. They see the advantages that other people have, and they want the same, and who wouldn't? And it just seems to me it's sort of dreaming to think that people would like to. And people speak of keeping their culture, and the culture as we see it is hunting and gathering. They don't see their culture that way necessarily. We call them hunter-gatherers. They call themselves the clear people, the pure people, the worthwhile people, or the harmless people. That's what they call themselves, and that's how they see themselves. It's us that sees them as Bushmen. We found them in the bush, or hunter-gatherers. That's how they got their food. They don't call themselves that.
Mm. Let's talk with one caller here when we still have time in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering how long your family stayed, where you lived before and after, and how old your brother was when you went.
My brother was 18. We lived at that time in Massachusetts before we left. I now live in New Hampshire. I was there about 3 years total, but my brother and the rest of my family was there much longer. My brother really spent his life working for the benefit of the Bushmen, and he did a great deal for them and with them, and so he was there throughout, and he only died a year ago, and just before he died, he had been there, so he really was the person who had continuous contact. And we did through him. The rest of us did through him. So that was... I went back once. Oh, no, I went back twice. But it was everything had changed by the time I got back. So by the time I went back. But he was there throughout the transition and helped people through the transition and into the transition. And he also lived in Massachusetts. And New Hampshire.
Uh-huh. A wonderful story.
Uh-huh. Thanks for the call. And he, I know that he made a long list of films as recently as, I think, 2001, 2002. He was still doing film work.
Oh, yes. And he did a fabulous film showing the whole time. He took films from the 1950s up to his death, just about. So throughout those 50 years, He was filming, and he made a wonderful film called A Kalahari Family about this group of people that we knew, and it's a magnificent film. It's a documentary.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how difficult or easy it would be to find the film for people who might like to see it.
Oh, it's easy. It's the place that distributes it is called Documentary Educational Resources, and it's that's D-E-R, and it's in the Watertown, Massachusetts. I'm hoping it's in Watertown. Let me see.
I'm sure people can probably go on to
the
web.
Yes, it will be. It's on the internet throughout. There's many sites that show. Okay. And Documentary Education Resources is certainly on the internet.
Yeah. How is it possible for you to say, I realize this may be a big question, about how it is that your life was changed by this experience? Perhaps if you had a slightly more conventional experience, you wouldn't be the person that you are today?
Oh, I think that's very true. I mean, it's for the rest of my life, I saw everything through the lens of the Kalahari, and it just showed me what we are as human beings, and it also made me see how other creatures, non-human creatures, live, what they're up against, and how they manage. It was very eye-opening for me. I am who I am because of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I write the same book over and over, incidentally.
Well, you must have felt the need to revisit this particular story, though, when you sat down to do this book, though.
Yes.
To go all the way back and again to write about from the very beginning about what it was like, what happened, how you went there when you were with your family when you were 19.
Very, very much so. A great deal of things have been learned about the ecosystem, about human origins, many other things that we didn't know. It was not known back in the 1950s, and I thought it was very good to go back and look at it all over again in the light of everything that's been learned since. That's why I wrote the book. Mm. Well, also to just do it and be, to revisit the experience, which was quite wonderful.
Well, if people who are listening to us would like to read this book, it is The Old Way, A Story of the First People, Foraster Ashiro, the publisher, by our guest Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. And indeed, you might also enjoy looking at her book, The Hidden Life of Dogs, or perhaps her novels, Reindeer Moon, The Animal Wife. All of those books, I'm sure that you can find them in the bookstore or in the library. And Ms. Thomas, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.